Now that raises the issue of stress eating. Does everybody know what stress eating is? Okay. Yeah, people who are nervous, they might have an exam the next day. They may be getting yelled at by their boss. They might eat a lot of junk food. Okay? So how do we consider stress eating? Well, they use stress eating as an example of lack of self-control. The prevailing view is you're not really enjoying that ice cream. You're dealing with your problems in life, and you're just dealing in an inappropriate way. And so a prevailing view might be actually reduce the stress. Okay? So then if stress eating actually serves its function, then you also have to give credit for that ice cream, that it's also serving this additional function. So basically, the ideal behavioral economics is add up all the pros and cons. Don't just look at the bad parts about something, but look holistically at the big picture. And the thing I really like about this book is it kind of combines two fascinating things. To me, economics is intrinsically fascinating, so that's kind of a no-brainer that I like that aspect of it. But then it's kind of the perfect intersection of economics and science, economics of biology and medicine, okay? Because economists can think about self-control and how that interacts with costs and benefits, but at the same time, in order to understand stress eating, you sort of have to understand the science of it as well. Now, there are two events in my life that kind of motivated me to write this book, two foundational experiences. One is I spent 10 years pricing health insurance in America. Okay? And one thing that health insurance companies are really enthusiastic about is how can we get people to lead healthier lives? Okay? And if insurance companies can do this, they're really combining two awesome things. One is they won't have to pay as much in claims. You know, if you don't get obese and have to go to the hospital, the insurance company saves money, potentially increases profits. Obviously, insurance companies like that. But counter to what some people in America think, people who work in insurance companies are also people like you and me, and if they could make people healthier and lead better lives, that's something that would really get them waking up in the morning in an enthusiastic fashion. So I would go to all these actuarial conferences. These are the people who price insurance products. And every conference would just have lots of sessions about obesity, about smoking, how can we get people to change their behavior. Okay, so that was an experience that was kind of a constant theme when I went to these conferences. The second experience is I taught healthcare economics at Muhlenberg College. Now, the first time I taught healthcare economics, I basically went to the previous teacher and said, hey, give me the textbook, all right? I didn't have time to reinvent the wheel, so I just used whatever textbook the previous year provided. And there was something interesting about that textbook. In the very beginning of the book, it said that in America, 50% of deaths are caused by health behaviors. 50% are caused by health behaviors. That's more than American doctors cause, okay? So this is a big deal. But did the textbook make it seem like a big deal the way it covered the material? Did it spend lots of chapters on smoking, lots of chapters on drinking? No, most of the focus was on traditional topics in the field such as doctors, hospitals, and insurance companies. The author knew that who your doctor wasn't as important as who you were and what you were doing with your health. The author of the textbook knew that hospitals and insurance companies weren't as important as whether or not you chose to smoke or you chose to become an alcoholic. But that wasn't reflected in the way the textbook was written. So what I thought was it would be this neat opportunity to really write a supplementary book that kind of filled in this gaping hole in the way healthcare economics was taught. Okay. So the book is called The Deadly Sins. So perhaps not surprisingly, there's seven main behaviors. The first five behaviors are sort of obvious topics in behavioral health. So there's eating, exercise, drinking alcohol, smoking, and sex. And then I added my two favorite activities, heroin and climbing Mount Everest. Now, not doing those activities, but researching those activities in order to round out the seven. Now, one thing that was kind of interesting is when I first started writing the book, which was a number of years now, I didn't write about heroin because it was a primary important topic. I wrote about it because I thought it was fascinating in the same way climbing Mount Everest was. However, in the last 7 years, something happened, the opioid epidemic. Now, when I say the phrase opioid epidemic, how many people specifically think about the United States? Okay. So there's a lot of people who specifically think about the United States, and then it seems like more people just think of it as the fact that in the world there are a lot of drugs being done and, you know, it's doing a lot of harm. Okay. Now, perhaps not surprisingly, coming from the United States, I'm going to focus on the U.S. experience, one, because I'm American and I know a lot more about America, and two, it really is a uniquely American thing in the sense that opioid deaths have just exploded in the U.S. And so we're going to spend a good amount of time today just talking about, you know, what caused that and what are some of the consequences of that. Before I begin the main talk, I'm just going to briefly run through four consequences of the fact that heroin and other drugs are illegal in the U.S. Because when you study health behavior economics of drugs, almost everything sort of revolves around the fact that drugs are illegal. Like, if you don't understand that about drugs, then, you know, you don't understand anything about drugs. So I'm going to quickly talk about four things that is a direct result of the fact that drugs are illegal. One is there are a lot of cartel violence in Mexico. So tons and tons of people are dying as a direct result of the fact that drugs are illegal in the U.S. I'm not going to talk about it, not the main focus. Okay. Another thing is that a huge number of people are incarcerated in the United States directly due to the fact that drugs are illegal in the United States. The United States has the largest prison population in the world. I believe it has the highest percentage incarceration in the world. And a real big chunk of it is that the United States takes a real hard stand on illegal drugs. Okay, so that's number two. Not going to talk about it anymore. Not the focus. Number three is we have the drug war, and a tremendous amount of money is spent on the drug war. Okay, it's pretty obvious that, you know, the DEA is very expensive. We have all these jails. You know, we're feeding prisoners. Very expensive. Not going to focus on that. And the last thing I'm not going to focus is that it ruins the lifestyle of opioid addicts. Now, some people are thinking, well, you know, if you're doing heroin, you're probably going to ruin your lifestyle anyway. You know, that may or may not be true, but it's definitely the case that because drugs are illegal, sort of the well-being and lifestyle of people who choose to do heroin, say, is dramatically worse. So getting drugs is a big hassle. And the quality of the drugs aren't very good, right? Now, the vast majority of people would never even give the lifestyle of opioid addicts and whether or not they get high-quality drugs a second thought. But that's something that a certain type of economist is very prone to do. You're adding up all the costs and benefits, and certainly the people involved with taking the drugs are certainly one party to the discussion. Now, that's a few consequences. We're going to leave that aside and just primarily now deal with one particular issue for the rest of the talk, and that's what about the health and well-being of people who take drugs and the health and well-being of other people in society, okay? And presumably, you know, we'll see how this shakes out. Okay. So in the U.S., the story of heroin begins in 1898. The Bayer Company brought heroin to the pharmaceutical marketplace. Now, I just thought this was the coolest fact when I first read about it. And just the fact that heroin is with a capital H, it sort of staggers the mind, right? So it's a brand name that the Bayer company picked, thought it would be a good thing for marketing, and did it in 1898. Now, one thing about that date is that if heroin was legal, heroin would be off patent, okay? So essentially, what would the price of heroin be, okay? Now, the following year, 1899, Bayer introduced another product, aspirin. Aspirin was a runaway success. A few people have suggested that if heroin was legal, then heroin wouldn't be any more expensive than aspirin. I find that plausible, but, you know, I'm not an expert on manufacturing, okay, drugs. But, you know, they're probably going to be in the same ballpark. And the fact that legal heroin would be very, very cheap will be very relevant for the rest of the discussion. Now, why would Bayer bring out heroin? Okay, so heroin really seemed like a wonder drug to Bayer. Okay, number one, heroin suppressed the coughing of pneumonia and tuberculosis. Now, I've never talked in front of a crowd of scientists or medical students before. So when I talk to economics people, I just have to explain that, you know, at that time, coughing was a very dangerous symptom of pneumonia and tuberculosis. So sort of suppressing the cough of tuberculosis patients could potentially save their life. And of course, tuberculosis is spread through coughing. So I would imagine that would be an additional benefit of heroin. The second thing that they thought was going to be great about heroin was you could use it as a tool to treat morphine addiction. So at that time, morphine would have been, the bad, ugly drug on the street, right? So Bayer says, this is great. People are suffering from morphine. Let's give them heroin instead. Now, from today's perspective, this is kind of funny because heroin is twice as potent as morphine. They had it kind of the wrong way around. The other important part about this is that Bayer thought that sniffing heroin was not going to be addictive. Not surprisingly, we know today that was very wrong. Heroin was very, very addictive. Now, so heroin was addictive, and it sort of unleashed a lot of negative aspects in society. I mean, a lot of people got into heroin, they became eyesores, there was some petty crime. It really wasn't considered a good thing, okay? The other thing is that there was international sort of agreement to try to do something about drugs, and so these forces in conjunction, the United States decided to outlaw a whole bunch of drugs. So in 1914, the Narcotics Tax Act limited legal opiate use to medical professional practice. Now, it's kind of strange that it's a tax act because for sort of bizarre legal reasons in the United States, in order for this to be sort of legal, outlawing all these drugs, they passed it under like a revenue bill. So a lot of the enforcement was done by the Treasury Department. So after this was passed, you still had doctors who wanted to use illegal drugs in order to treat drug addiction. So previously, we saw that Bayer wanted to treat morphine addiction with heroin. And we know now that has it switched, because heroin's twice as potent as morphine. So you had doctors who wanted to use morphine in order to treat heroin addiction. And a couple years after the Harrison Act comes out, the U.S. decides, no, that does not fit the qualifications of professional practice. So essentially, in the United States at that time, there was this notion that you can't treat one drug addiction with another drug habit. Okay, and so in the U.S., there's still this legacy where a lot of people are very reluctant to use one drug to treat another drug. Okay. Now, this has a secondary knock-on effect because some doctors kind of persisted in treating one drug with another drug, and thousands of them were punished. And so a secondary effect of all these doctors getting punished is doctors became sort of wary of prescribing drugs in general. And so this probably dampened the prescription of opioids for pain relief for decades to come. So then what happens? Heroin's illegal. Do people stop using heroin at this point? No, perhaps not surprisingly. Criminal dealers replace legal vendors. And the price of heroin gets increased dramatically. Okay? So what happens when the price of heroin goes up? One thing that happens is that injection becomes far more common. Okay? And coincidentally, 1914 is the first year that sharing needles in drug usage is a thing in the United States. So basically, you have this new law that kind of encourages people to switch to injection. And then some of these people will begin to start sharing needles. So basically, you take one dangerous activity and you ramp it up by sharing the needles, another dangerous activity. So at this time, heroin use sort of becomes associated with serious criminal activity. And there's this one quote which I, from specialists in addiction from this time period, when they talk about the effect of the criminalization, is they say, addiction is becoming more and more a vicious practice of unstable people who by their nature have abnormal cravings, which impel them to take much larger doses than those which are taken by the average person who so often innocently fell victim to narcotics some years ago. So basically, there is always opioid addicts in the United States, but this specialist, these two specialists believe that making the drugs illegal kind of coarsened or made the problem worse. Now, so we see that making drugs illegal had three impacts. So it probably discouraged using drugs for pain relief. It certainly discouraged using drugs to treat the drug addiction. And it certainly encouraged people to switch to injection. So those are like three pretty big negatives, okay? So one positive potentially is it discouraged people from beginning using heroin in the first place. Now, you know, they didn't have tremendous research budgets in 1914 back then. And so I don't really know whether or not on net this was good or bad. However, just from what I've read, the people at the time, you know, not a lot of good stuff is being said about this necessarily. Okay. So this is sort of the first wave of heroin addiction in U.S. history. Now what I'm going to do is fast forward about 60-some years into the current day, and we're going to see that a lot of the themes from the previous slides are going to play out again in modern history. And then we'll continue to ask ourselves, are things being made better or made things by worse, given the fact that drugs are illegal? Now, typically, when people talk about the opioid epidemic in the United States, they talk about three phases. Okay, today I'm going to start the conversation with what I call phase zero. And phase zero seems awfully benign. And by and large, I think phase zero is probably a good thing. Inadvertently, some problems happened, which will take time to work themselves out. But the essence of phase one is in the United States, the medical profession decided that we wanted to more aggressively treat pain. That in the U.S., lots of people suffered, and maybe some of that suffering was unnecessary. Okay? One of the sparks of this change in attitude was research published in 1980 in the New England Journal of Medicine. And what this research claimed was that narcotic use for pain relief was widespread, and unless the person already had an opioid addiction, rarely led to any type of addiction, okay? So to the extent that this research is valid, this is a pretty compelling point that all of these people who are in intense pain, maybe we should be doing something about this. Now, many people argue that this is, you know, one of the most influential papers in recent medical history. It was cited over 600 times. Now, in economics, if you get 600 citations, you could probably get tenure a couple times over. In the medical profession, 600 is a pretty big number as well. So this was an extraordinarily influential paper. Another thing that influenced this attitude with pain is that the American Pain Society started talking up pain as a fifth vital sign. Okay? So what they're saying is that pain isn't just some inconvenience, okay? But really what you should treat pain as is as an essential part of a person's health. Okay? And so this urging of people to rethink how they consider pain comes in 1996. And we're going to see that this year, 1996, coincidentally is very important later on in the presentation. It got to the point that by 2001, people who, the organization that accredits hospitals in the United States, issued standards of what pain management should be. So basically, hospitals couldn't continue into the old ways of just neglecting pain, okay? Now, personally, I, for one, am a huge fan of phase zero. A couple years ago, I had a blood clot in this leg, and I got Tramadol. And I have to say, had I not gotten Tramadol, I would have went to a very, very dark place. So these socks, fashionable, but they also have a very important medical role. Now, the second interesting experience, me using Tramadol, was that I got to experience the side effects of opioids. So here I am, like I spend all this time writing about heroin, okay? Am I going to use heroin in order to do research for my book? No way. I'm kind of chicken, right? So I don't use heroin. I don't know anybody who does know heroin. Okay. So basically, I start taking this Tramadol, and I say, oh, all these things I'm reading about with heroin, I kind of get some smaller impacts of it, right? So if you do heroin, you get pretty bad constipation. Me, I take Tramadol? Well, I won't continue on. But anyway, so that was, you know, that was an interesting experience. But overall, phase zero, had a lot going for it. Okay, I mentioned that influential research. This is the research, okay? This isn't the abstract of the research. This is the entire thing. Five sentences, okay? Now, one thing about this, it's a letter to the editor. Back then in New England Journal of Medicine, letters to the editor were not peer-reviewed. Okay? People make a big deal about the fact that this wasn't peer-reviewed. It was just two people who dug around their files, sent a five-sentence letter to New England Journal of Medicine, and they changed the course of modern medical history in the United States. Now, people make a point about it being not peer-reviewed. I haven't seen people really making the claim that it's not true. Okay, but again, one very important part about this is we conclude that despite widespread use of narcotic drugs in hospitals, so the key is hospitals are very controlled environments, okay? If you start getting strung out on your opioid meds in a hospital, the doctor's going to react, hopefully, right? But then in phase one, the medical profession is getting much laxer about the pain relief. So in 1996, Purdue Pharma introduced OxyContin. And so OxyContin was designed to relieve pain for a 12-hour stretch. So this was going to be much more convenient for the user. So instead of taking 4 to 6 pills a day, you just take 2 pills of OxyContin. And Purdue Pharma convinced the medical profession that OxyContin was safe. Okay? They started using this 1980 research as sort of evidence that opioids were safe. Now, of course, people getting these prescriptions of OxyContin weren't in the hospital environment. OxyContin is a pretty strong stuff. So the experience of OxyContin really doesn't have much to do with that 1980 letter. Okay? And another thing that was unfortunate is OxyContin is extremely addictive for many people. Many people don't have their pain relieved for 12 hours taking OxyContin. So if you take OxyContin, you don't have pain for 6 hours. You have pain for 6 hours. Then you take another pill, pain 6 hours, no pain 6 hours, so on and so forth. That's a super unpleasant experience for the patient, but it's also kind of a formula for addiction, right? So it was a pretty ugly situation. Purdue kind of insisted, no, keep the 12 hours, just ramp up the dosage. Well, ramping up the dosage of OxyContin wasn't such a good idea either. Okay. Another problem with OxyContin is people started abusing it. So OxyContin has this 12-hour pain relief mechanism. If you crush it, you can actually ingest it such that your body absorbs the drugs right away. Okay? So something that was supposed to be an even keel started being used as a prime drug of misuse. And the medical profession, the shadier, more reprehensible parts of the medical profession actually started facilitating the misuse of OxyContin. There are certain pill mills, especially in Florida, that were basically sending out huge amounts of OxyContin to people which, they had no evidence for the fact that these people needed the prescription. And so they were basically enabling lots of people to become abusers of OxyContin. Okay, so that's phase one, okay? Eventually what happens is people are aware that OxyContin was addictive. People are aware that Purdue Pharmaceuticals were kind of misleading people. And so then the medical establishment started kind of trying to right the course. However, the problem is once you get people who are addicted to drugs, and then you make getting addicted to legal prescriptions to be a big hassle. It's harder to get a doctor to give you a large supply of the drug, and it becomes more expensive. Okay, what happened is a lot of people then switched to using heroin. So during phase two, the people who started abusing heroin, 80% of them started out as people that had used prescription drugs. Okay, so this is kind of a very unique situation in the history of drugs. Now, one of the unfortunate things is that once people are addicted to opioids, there's a lot of things that seemingly should be benign that can actually backfire. So people know that OxyContin is being abused. Why don't you make a type of OxyContin that if you smash it, you don't get the immediate drug use, okay? So you make a tamper-resistant version of OxyContin. Well, there's some good evidence that people who could no longer misuse OxyContin switched to heroin, okay? Two types of evidence. One is they interviewed a bunch of people that used to abuse OxyContin after the fact and said, well, what happened? A lot of them said, I stopped abusing OxyContin. And then a lot of people said, I started abusing heroin. So a second piece of evidence is that OxyContin was more likely to be abused in some states than other states. Okay? So one thing that influenced the prevalence of OxyContin was certain rules about prescribing. So in a couple states were called triplicate states where if you wanted to prescribe OxyContin, you had to fill out a triplicate, the doctor himself, a triplicate form. Purdue Pharma knew doctors aren't going to want to do this, and they didn't market as much in those triplicate states. So in any case, attempts to make OxyContin tamper-resistant caused some people to switch to heroin. The impact of that didn't really reduce any lives, saving of lives, because you're transferring overdose deaths from one bucket to another bucket. But a later research came up and said, because injecting increased, we think that things like hepatitis and other diseases associated with injection actually increased. So there's this potential for something that would seem to be very benign to actually go astray. So waves one and two have to do with the medical profession. Phase three is the most dangerous wave, okay? And really, the medical profession can't be blamed at all for it. Basically, people in laboratories came up with a more cost-efficient drug than heroin. Now, heroin is a product of both agriculture and laboratory work. Okay, you can't make heroin without plants. And it's kind of inconvenient to make these plants because these plants require an arid environment. Okay, so, you know, you can grow them in various countries, but then you have this big field where, you know, people know, can come and find out where you are. Okay, so agriculture is sort of an intrinsic downside to the model of making drugs. So what developed was completely synthetic drugs that were cheaper and more powerful. The most famous one is fentanyl. The Center of Disease Control, which is one of the primary, if not the primary, sort of medical establishment in the United States, estimates that fentanyl is 50 times more potent than heroin. Okay? So that's a pretty staggering fact. Okay? Now, the other thing about fentanyl is it's very, very powerful. And so dealers started using it everywhere. They used it in heroin. They used it in cocaine. They even made fake prescription drugs using fentanyl. So a lot of people are fairly confident that Prince died by taking a fake prescription drug. Okay. So during this phase of the opioid epidemic, the new users changed. So during phase one and two, you had an atypical crowd for becoming drug addicts. A lot of the drug addicts were sort of middle-aged people. You don't normally think of middle-aged people becoming heroin addicts. But during phase two, you know, that was happening a lot. Phase three is being shifted to sort of the more traditional crowd that people associate with heroin users. So it's skewing younger as opposed to the more middle age. Okay, so this chart gives a sense of just how dramatic, the increase in the drug problem is. Okay, so this purple you see is the prescription, so that's phase one. And then it hits the peak and phase two starts. So the prescription drugs are pretty constant at this point, but heroin jumps up. Okay. So now the synthetic drugs are the black line, and they're pretty unimpressive until relatively recently, and they just shoot up. Okay. So this issue has actually been one of the primary drivers of a very interesting fact about American health, which is 2015, 2016, and 2017, life expectancy in the U.S. dropped those 3 years. So basically 3 years in a row, okay? So that really hadn't happened until sort of the AIDS, the height of the AIDS epidemic. So not surprisingly, this, gets a lot of discussion in the United States. Now, there's some people have some good reasons to believe that this would get even worse. Thankfully, in 2018, life expectancy in the U.S., didn't get worse. So hopefully this problem may have moderated somewhat. So this is the fact of the history, okay? And so based upon this history, I'm going to combine it with a couple fairly obvious observations. Now, they're not obvious observations in the fact that they would occur to everyone, but basically people who understand sort of the biology of heroin and opioids, it won't be too surprising. But they're important points that not everybody would think about, okay? So before we get to these major points, I just want to briefly talk about what overdose is. For the people who are medical students, it's probably not going to be horribly educational. But overdose is basically heroin causes respiratory depression so that an overdose victim literally dies because they stop breathing, okay? Addicts, they start taking heroin. They develop a tolerance for the pleasure of heroin, and they develop a tolerance for the pain relief mechanisms of heroin, okay? So if you're taking heroin for one of these two reasons, any given dosage you have isn't going to give you the same effect over time, okay? So happily or not happily, you can sort of, get that same effect by increasing the dosage. Okay, so, left unrestricted, a lot of heroin users are just going to take more and more heroin. However, at the same time, you develop a tolerance for the respiratory depression. So basically, these sort of tolerances have to move in sync. Otherwise, you might take a dosage of heroin that's too much for your respiratory system to handle. Okay. Now, tolerance for the respiratory depression can decrease relatively quickly after you stop using the drug. Now, there's two obvious times when you're going to stop using heroin. One is when you go into detox. If you decide to go into rehab and detox, you stop using, and your tolerance is going to go down. Unfortunately, going into rehab or detox is actually a very dangerous thing because it's obviously foolproof if you can stay off heroin, but if you relapse, it's going to be more dangerous than it would have been otherwise because of you've lost your tolerance. The second natural time for heroin addicts to lose their tolerance is when they go to jail. Not surprisingly, people do less heroin in jail if they're a heroin addict. Now, there's a crucial difference between people who come out of rehab and people who come out of jail, okay? People come out of rehab, most of them, I would assume, or many of them, because they wanted to stop using heroin. If you want to do something, you just might do it. The people who are sent to jail, who are heroin addicts, did they go to jail to stop using heroin? No. In jail, they may have detox, okay? So they may not have any withdrawal symptoms when they come out, but they still have the craving of doing heroin, and so it's very, very common for them to relapse, and because of their lack of tolerance, they're going to have a dangerous situation. Now, the fact that they're in jail very commonly can be directly attributed to the fact that heroin is illegal. So it's very common for the well-intentioned trying to help the addict to sort of backfire because they're putting them in a situation that's going to become a very dangerous situation. So another situation that's kind of a direct result of drug illegalization is injection. So, there's a common type of different common types of ingestion of heroin that users begin with, but a lot of times they migrate to injection. Now, injection has a lot of serious downsides, right? So if you like to wear short sleeves like me, it's going to be embarrassing. If you go to your phlebotomist, you might irritate her because it's very difficult for her to do her job. But then it has a more important downside, which is the fact that it's going to increase the likelihood of an overdose. If you're sort of sniffing heroin fumes, it's very likely that you're going to get a sense of what the concentration of the drug is before you have an overdose. But if you're injecting, it's much less likely that you're going to have this warning. Okay. Now, why do people switch to injection? It could be because some of them prefer the high, so I'll grant that that's often the case. But very commonly, and probably typically, it's the fact that injecting is the most cost-efficient way of getting high with heroin. With sniffing, a lot of the drug, you know, just kind of floats away, okay? Now, injection becomes even more dangerous now that you go to this fentanyl world. In fact, one emergency responder said that if the needle is still in the arm of the victim, that they can tell it's fentanyl. Okay, so it's kind of a new age in sort of the injection. Now, I mentioned that the transition to injection frequently is based upon getting the right price for your high. Okay, and I also mentioned that in a legal drug environment, heroin would be off patent. So a lot of these injection deaths can directly be linked to the fact that drugs are illegal. Here's an interesting picture that kind of shows you the difference in potency of heroin and fentanyl. Now, I don't know if I can trust this exactly, whether or not this is 50 times as much as that. But one thing that is very clear is that a fatal dose of fentanyl, there's not a lot there. Okay. Now, the fact that fentanyl is so strong can cause overdoses for two reasons. One, it could be that you just want to take a huge amount of drugs that would give you a fatal overdose, and fentanyl is the only way to do it. But in general, people aren't trying to find fentanyl. Okay, you know, like an interesting fact about fentanyl is there's not a lot of street names for fentanyl. Okay, like in the U.S., there's like 20 different words for like marijuana and other drugs. You know, I know in Spanish there's a lot of different words to say the names of some of these drugs as well. But fentanyl, you know, that's not the primary focus of what people are after. But the potency of fentanyl can cause an overdose in a third manner, and that's because of the fluctuation of drug purity. Now, one of the impacts of that's going to make a drug overdose more likely is when the purity of the drug fluctuates, because if you're trying to target one level of dosage that you can handle from a tolerance standpoint, if the purity is fluctuating lower and higher over time, at some point you just might get purity higher than your system can handle, right? And so there have been studies that showed that when the average purity of the drug increases in a city, there's an increase in the overdoses. Now, I'm not claiming this is a huge impact, but it's definitely an effect. But of course, drug purity fluctuates from dose to dose, so it's not just the drug purity fluctuating in a given city. Now, what does this have to do with fentanyl? Okay. Well, fentanyl, that's how much can kill you, and you're trying to dose it out, okay? Just doing this efficiently in a stable manner is probably more than these illegal drug cartels are up to. So basically, It's very easy to sort of measure out like a cup of sugar and get within a couple percent of a cup of sugar, right? Like measuring that out with any type of precision, it's not going to be your local drug dealers who are going to be able to do it. Could Purdue Pharmaceutical do it? Maybe, right? You couldn't trust them, perhaps, but you could trust them to be able to, you know, make the drug in the right consistency. So one of the things I want to do, give you my email address. So I mentioned that I'm in the process of submitting this book to various publishers. But I would really love to get feedback from people with a technical background. I mentioned that behavioral health economics is sort of the marriage of economics and sort of science. I have a PhD from Princeton, which is a good econ school. My biology background is ninth grade biology. So, you know, if I had some med students read it and give me feedback, that would be a great help. So if you're interested in getting a draft of it, just send me an email.